Welcome to Anthony Plog on Music. This is Eddie Ludema, the show's producer, here to introduce you to Tony's guest, Chad Goodman. To quote Christina Wallace from Forbes magazine, Chad is an entrepreneur bringing innovation to classical music. When Chad was a young conductor, he created and managed the Elevate Ensemble, worked with the San Francisco Symphony and the San Francisco Ballet as a conductor, is a conducting fellow with the New World Symphony, and was recently appointed as the music director of the Elgin Symphony Orchestra. So how did he do all of this at such a young age? He gives us a lot of clues and practical advice in his book, You Earned a Music Degree, Now What? In part one, Tony and Chad go back to the start of Chad's career, not only learning about music, but also learning about the business of music. At a very young age, he founded the Elevate Ensemble. He talks about the different practical aspects of planning concerts, like paying musicians, arranging concert venues, and working with sponsors. Then they trace Chad's career to working with the San Francisco Symphony, assisting guest conductors, and how Manfred Honeck was such a profound influence on him.
So Chad Goodman, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Tony. Very happy to be speaking with you.
Well, I hope you don't mind, but I'm going to use you to illustrate a point or points, which is how to develop a career. Because at a fairly young age, you have a fantastic career going already. And it's in a way, it's sort of self-made. So if you don't mind, I'd like to go back to the beginning when you started in music and how you got involved in music. So I know early on you were a trumpet player. Did you have an instrument before then?
I did not. I started playing trumpet when I was 8 years old, and my father and my grandfather both played trumpet. My father still plays, actually. Neither of them did it professionally. My grandfather had a business that he ran and played with a big band on the side, though, during the big band era, and my dad picked up trumpet as well and got to play through all those amazing years when trumpet players were like the hippest thing, you know, when it was like Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Tower of Power, Chicago, everyone had a horn section. And like I said, he still plays today, which is wonderful, but that was my first instrument. And so I actually played my father's old trumpet. He hadn't played for many years. And when I picked an instrument and set it on trumpet, he picked up the trumpet again and has been playing nonstop since that point as well. I started piano later on as well. At the end of high school, I picked up piano, but trumpet is the dominant instrument for me.
And did you start piano because you had the thought that you might eventually go into conducting, or just because you wanted to?
Yeah, no, I actually had no, we'll get into that. I had no thoughts when I was younger of going into conducting. It had never crossed my mind. Even when I was doing my bachelor's at the conservatory, I had never thought about conducting. I started with piano just because I knew it was a requirement when you got into, you know, music school, was you had to do several semesters of piano classes. And I obviously knew as well that it wouldn't hurt to be able to, you know, move my way around a keyboard. So I just started at the end of high school just to get some basics going.
And you went to Eastman. So obviously by that time you wanted a career in music.
Yes. And I knew very early on, I knew by the age of 13, I wanted to play music professionally. And 13 was the year I joined the Maryland Youth Symphony Orchestra. It was the first time I played classical music. I played in like a band program in the public school system I was in. And my first teacher was an incredible lead trumpet player. He was, at the time that I started working with him, the lead player of the Navy Commodores Jazz Band and was the first call lead player for all of the shows in the Baltimore, D.C., Virginia area. So my start on the instrument, after initial lessons with my dad at the very beginning, was working exclusively in jazz. And it wasn't until I joined a youth orchestra at age 13 that like my whole world was turned upside down, and I fell absolutely in love with it. And yeah, that same year, I just sort of proudly told my family and friends, like, I'm going to play in an orchestra for a living. That's what I'm going to do. And I never questioned that moving forward. I didn't have any thoughts in high school. It was like, that's the course. I'm going to be principal trumpet. I wanted Phil Smith's job. I wanted to be principal trumpet of the New York Philharmonic. So yeah, that was the goal.
Well, hopefully one day you'll conduct the New York Philharmonic.
I hope so too. I would love that.
So you went to Eastman, is that right? Okay. And did you study with Barbara Butler and Charlie Geyer or with Jim Thompson?
I studied with Jim Thompson. So yeah, Barbara and Charlie had left a few years earlier. And so I moved there and studied with Jim, who was an incredible inspiration for me, and had such a unique approach in how he taught. And basically his goal from day one, he would tell all of us, was, my goal is to teach you to teach yourself. I want you to be like a doctor. I want you to be able to diagnose issues whenever you something goes wrong and you flub something, something's out of tune, whatever, I want you to be able to stop and diagnose the problem. And then oftentimes the problem was something before that note that you missed. It was something leading up to it. He changed and really helped shape how I refined the music I was making, which later on would carry on into conducting when I am working with a full orchestra. It wasn't just solely applicable on the horn, but he was a very big inspiration for me and an incredible mentor while I was at Eastman.
Mm-hmm. And so if, for example, if you're conducting and there's a train wreck on bar 75, you can almost go back and think, well, it probably happened on bar 60 or something like that leading up to it.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's often, it might be a couple notes, it might be a couple bars, but there's usually the culprit is something that they weren't setting themselves up for success at that climactic, you know, specific passage. So
you graduate from Eastman. And then did you go to San Francisco right after that?
I moved immediately to San Francisco to do a master's degree in trumpet. So still no conducting at all. I'm still set on having a trumpet career. And I was studying with a trumpet player out there, Adam Luftman, who was principal trumpet. At the time, he was principal trumpet of San Francisco Opera, which he still has. But then he later won the principal trumpet position with the San Francisco Ballet. So he has both of those positions. And just an extraordinary player who I had met in high school doing a side-by-side concert with the Baltimore Symphony where I grew up. And that was his first professional job. And I had met him there. We went our separate ways. I went to Eastman. And while I was in Rochester, I drove with friends, a bunch of brass buddies. We would drive to Cleveland once or twice a year to go hear Cleveland Orchestra concerts. And we saw Ein Heldenleben, and I saw Adam Luffman was playing one of the E-flat parts. And I ran into him backstage, and he remembered me. And he said, "Hey, I'm out in San Francisco now. I'm doing this festival out there. I'm on faculty. Come out and study with me for the summer." So I did. And then it led to him encouraging me to try and get out there for grad school. And so that's what I did. So I moved out there for trumpet.
And I met you in San Francisco, actually, for the first time. And you had done some duets, or I think arranged or orchestrated duets for trumpet from the music of Carl Nielsen, if I remember correctly. And was that around when you were starting to think of being a conductor? Because I remember we talked not just about the trumpet, but about career opportunities.
Yeah. So the way conducting came into the folds was I was out there studying trumpet. And within the first semester of my master's degree, I really hit it off with the wind ensemble director, a man named Martin Zegelka. And he pulled me aside very quickly and said, "You're doing really beautiful things on the instrument, on trumpet. I love the way you make music, and I love talking with you outside of classes about music. I just have a feeling you would make a very fine conductor. Can I just offer you weekly lessons for free?" And so I thought, sure, why not? This had never crossed my mind. I never took like an undergraduate, you know, basics of conducting course or anything, but I thought this will help my trumpet playing. Why not? Gain the bigger picture of what's going on in all this music I'm playing. And I fell in love with it, and I became the assistant conductor by the next semester.
Of the band?
Yes, of the band, of the wind ensemble. But then I started working a little bit with the orchestra too, which was great. And then I actually still had a career as a trumpet player following grad school. I was freelancing with about five or six of the professional regional orchestras in the Bay Area. It's referred to as the freeway Philharmonic out there. So everyone's just driving many hours on the road playing. And I actually had a private teaching studio. I think at the most I was teaching 20 students a week. So I was really...
Wow.
I was doing a lot. I mean, you know, I needed to support myself in San Francisco, which is not exactly a cheap place to live. So I was doing all of that, but I knew that I wanted to keep pursuing conducting. And so I thought, I'll take the field of dreams mentality. Like, you know, I'll start my own group. If I build it, they will come, you know? And so I thought, if I can figure out the business side and like coordinating everything, I can just hire all of these people I'm playing with in all these great orchestras and give them opportunities in the city where they don't have to drive 3 hours for that, you know, for that per service gig. Maybe I can offer them something right in the city. And so I decided to just go for it. And I founded a flexible instrumentation ensemble. It was called Elevate Ensemble. And my goal from the start was whatever I start, I have to pay musicians. That's crucial. I'm not going to take advantage of musicians' time and not pay. But I also have never done fundraising. I don't know anything about nonprofit, not-for-profit world. So like I'll make it a flexible group where maybe at most is like 18 or 20 musicians, but I could also do like a Stravinsky Soldier's Tale program or something and pay seven people. And this way it was feasible and realistic to me from the very start that I could learn to fund this. And I did my first show in what was actually a yoga studio. It wasn't even in like a concert hall. It was in a yoga studio in the suburbs of San Francisco. And I did a program with, it was like six pieces, way too ambitious. I commissioned a little piece and I paid for the whole first show out of pocket. I just said, okay, I'll cover all this. And then I have to figure out fundraising and all of this. You know, I promised the musicians, I said, moving forward, like there aren't shows happening unless I'm paying you, you know, like that's my promise to you. And I commissioned a short little fanfare and I had this big program and it was not contemporary music only, but there were several modern pieces, contemporary works, but like the big piece was Dvorak's Serenade for Winds. That was the big one. I had a Martinu piece called Les Rondes, which is like a mixed septet, a little Mio chamber symphony. It was a really fun program. And I ended up having about 100 people show up to a yoga studio in the outskirts of the city for this first ever concert. And so I thought, well, I figured out I'm doing something right. If I'm having people show up, they're willing to pay. And it's not even in like a concert hall. It's just a very random pop-up kind of thing. And so from that point on, I then put together a little advisory board of people that could help and fleshed out a full season for the next year. And I established a composer in residency program and basically picked a young composer from the San Francisco Bay Area that we would do multiple commissions from over a season. That way they get more work. I can shine a spotlight on them and hopefully maybe eventually an international spotlight on some of these great young composers, because as hard as it is to make it as a conductor, an instrumentalist, you know, to make it as a composer is just, it's another level. And I think that's one of the privileges and responsibilities that you get as a conductor is you can actually help so many composers get their careers off the ground. And so the thing ended up taking off and during my first full season conducting the group, we did shows in some concert halls, some traditional spaces like the San Francisco Conservatory of Music and their small recital hall. But then I started, we did a show in like this beautiful old historic Victorian house in the city. And that became a thing that people were really excited about. And I worked with a chef and we did a little tapas menu, you know, to go along with it. And I ended up getting featured, oddly enough, in Forbes magazine, wrote an article on me, someone I was connected with, who was grew up doing music. She was at this point working in the tech world. And I had just been introduced to her. I told her what I was up to. And then a couple months later, I get an email out of the blue saying, Chad, I'm now a writer for Forbes. I'd love to do an article on what you're doing with your group Elevate Ensemble. It's, you know, like essentially your classical music startup, right? That was the buzzword of the time and of especially being in, you know, right by Silicon Valley. And so she wrote this big article on what I was doing and my vision and how I was connecting with younger audiences. And that really gave me a, like instant credibility. It was a very exciting, but also frustrating experience because nothing changed. Like I was putting out the product at high levels as I could from the start, but now all of a sudden this external validation from a very established, you know, periodical journal. All it took was that. And then all these people who knew I was doing this, but didn't seem to give it the time of day were all of a sudden like, oh, Chad's in Forbes. Oh yeah, his group's in Forbes. But you know, it was a great thing. And so it sort of started to snowball. And that was sort of the baseline for conducting following grad school. I never got a degree in conducting. I just studied privately, was the assistant conductor of the wind ensemble. And then started my own group, and that was the beginning of it all.
So let's go back to the beginning of it all with Elevate. And so the first concert you said you paid totally out of your own pocket. And how many players did you have?
I think it was 11, because that was I think Dvorak's Serenade for Winds, it's 11 or 12 players, but I think it's 11.
Okay. And how many rehearsals?
So I had three rehearsals, and that was the first challenge and hurdle for me being someone who had never, when I had done any playing, it was either organized by someone else because I was freelancing with it, with the group, or it was like a brass quintet. It's easy enough to put together, but scheduling 11 full-time working, teaching professional musicians to agree to three rehearsals and a show was such a pain. I remember being so frustrated and, you know, I had people, I don't think I was able to have everyone there at a single one of those rehearsals until the dress, you know? And so it was a real challenge learning how to coordinate as well.
And that must have been actually quite expensive if you have three rehearsals and the concert, if you're paying the normal fee.
Yeah, I was paying a little bit less. It was basically, I asked just directly friends. And I said, I can pay you something. I can't pay you what you're going to get, you know, with XYZ Symphony Orchestra. But my promise is from this point after this show, I'm going to be fundraising. I'm going to apply for grants and it'll be different from then on. So the first one was really just friends doing it for a smaller amount of money, but it's still, I had to rent the venue. I had to rent chairs because it was a yoga studio. There's no chairs. So I had to rent a van to go pick up chairs to drive to set up myself. I bought all the refreshments to sell at the intermission and I paid for a commission as well. So, you know, I paid for a piece to be written. So it was a lot. But I knew I needed to have the first thing. I wanted it to be professional from the start. Some people, you know, slide into things and gradually build, but I wanted the first thing I ever did as a conductor to feel established. And to feel professional. And, you know, I did everything I could to make that a reality.
It sounds like that was really a hit. And so when you got into fundraising and going for grants, I assume that was like a totally new area for you as well. And I'm thinking back on an interview I did with David Collins and Sarah Siu when they started the Dublin Brass Week. And when they did fundraising, they talked about this idea that a lot of people, when they fundraise, that get one big, huge donor. And they were not able to do that. And so they ended up having to get a lot of smaller donors, which in the end, they think saved them. Because if you just have one big donor and then all of a sudden something happens and they can't contribute anymore, you're toast, basically. And they got many, many donors, maybe even just for an airfare for a visiting artist or something like that. Did you get one donor or a lot of donors, or how did you go about you'd be totally new to this, I guess. So how do you call somebody? What would you say on the phone when you call somebody?
Yeah, well, I started actually for the first full season. I did, our first concert was in May. And so basically a traditional end of season. And then I wanted to see how that went. And when that went really well, I said, okay, I'll build a full season, which in this case, I think it was three concerts between the following September and that following May. And, you know, I built that out and looked at cost of what this would actually need. And then I did like a crowdfunding campaign, like the equivalent of a Kickstarter. There was another Kickstarter equivalent that was exclusively for like nonprofits, where the people who supported could get, you know, tax write-offs or whatever for it. So there were tax deductible donations. And so that was what I did for the start. And so it ended up being, like you said, the latter, it was a lot of small contributions. You know, a lot of people giving $50, $100, but this added up. And because I was maybe using during that first season, maybe 10 players at most on a program, you know, I was able to quickly cover like the cost of performers' expenses and things like that. And I had a few larger ones, but it was definitely a learning curve. And you can't really ask people for large sums of money, even if they have it at the start. When you're new, you can't really do that. And so when I would make an ask to someone that I know contributes $20,000, $30,000 to another organization, like it's nothing, they maybe wrote me at most a $500 check, because for them, they also want to see the success of where that money's going. And so, you know, I ran the thing on a shoestring budget. It was tight, but I made sure that we were able to cover everything that needed to be covered. And so we started applying for grants. And at the start of that process, you get rejections because you are new and a lot of them don't want to support. They want a track record. It's the classic case of you need more experience before we can give this to you. And you're like, that's why I'm applying for this. You know, I need the experience. So give me that first shot. But it was the same deal with that. You would write, you know, to maybe these smaller local grant giving organizations and ask for $5,000, and they would give us a grant and it would be for $1,000. So you'd ask for 10 and they'd give us $3,500. And so we were getting them, but they were still most of the time weren't even for the amount that we were asking for. So it's a long road, especially because we were a young organization. I had this like advisory board and we were all young. I picked people that I wanted to see in our seats. So I picked people in their late 20s, early 30s, you know, up to, you know, early 40s was my group that was helping me at this point get things off the ground. And the challenge with that is that people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s aren't philanthropists, even if they have money. There's a lot of money in the tech world out there, but they don't understand. They go, oh, I just paid for a ticket to come to the show. What do you mean you want me to write you a check right now? Like, I don't get it. I just paid you for that. Isn't that enough? And you have to explain, no, this is not for profit. Like, the goal is to break even if you're lucky. Most nonprofits don't even do that on a yearly basis. And so that became an interesting challenge for us, was getting those larger donations and getting people to do multiple donations. Because sometimes you do, you have someone who writes you a nice check and they do it once. And so it becomes about maintaining relationships. And I learned plenty of things about that along the way.
So writing for grants and getting an advisory board, you were totally new to this game, I imagine. And so I'm wondering, like somebody listening to this interview thinking, gee, I'd like to do something like that. It's like, you don't really have to know that much at the beginning. You just have to be willing to invest a lot of time to learn about it. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, it's the classic case of, I had no idea what I was getting myself into. Like, had I taken, like, you know, done an MBA program, studied business, I would have maybe been better equipped and could have done things quicker and more efficiently. But I may have also been scared to try, because it is a tremendous amount of work. I mean, the music, making music and conducting, for me, that was the back burner. Like, that was like, I would study the music 6 months in advance, because everything went into logistics and marketing and getting tickets, whether they're going to be physically printed or digital tickets, the venues, getting a liquor license for a day so you can, you know, sell glasses of wine or beer at the venue. Like, everything becomes the business, and the music is unfortunately way on the back when it comes to the priorities of getting a concert to happen. So when it came to putting together the advisory board, I picked several different types of people. First, I picked people that had big social circles. I had a friend that she had grown up, we played music. She was a trumpet player actually back in Maryland. And we had met there and then parted ways. We reconnected in San Francisco, and she was working in the tech world and was very entrenched in that. But she wanted to find an outlet, a way to get reconnected with the arts and with music. And so I invited her to be a part of this. And basically, she was someone who, for that first show I did, I told her way in advance. And she said, I'd love to bring a lot of my friends from the tech and finance world who haven't been to a classical music concert. Can you tell me what's in that area? What are some restaurants? I'll find a restaurant and maybe we'll just make a night of it. I'll like book out the room. We'll reserve a room at the back of the restaurant. And that's what she did. And this one person alone, she brought maybe 20 people to my first concert. So one person brought 20. I think it's what Malcolm Gladwell refers to as like connectors. I think it's in Tipping Point. He talks about that. So I was like, I want people that are like that, where when they're excited about something, they eat at a new restaurant. They then write to all of their friends, go, you need to check this out. And so I had people like that. I also had people who had experience with music administration. And I picked someone as well who also was doing work as a day job. He was a composer, but he was, for a day job, doing search engine optimization and web design. So I was like, this is someone who's going to be able to build a real website and drive traffic, you know, online to find our group, to find our website, to find our events. And so I was strategic in who I was picking, but I didn't have the traditional approach, because I didn't know people, where it's usually the case where you have a couple people who are going to be the big supporters, and they'll go, hey, you know, we're all in for $100,000 to help, you know, give you seed money. I didn't have that. I had people who were young and hungry and excited to be a part of something new that they were, you know, passionate about. And that's where I started. So it was a challenge, but you are right. You can just go for it. I think the biggest challenge is also overthinking things. It's very easy to get overwhelmed and not pull the trigger and not take the first step. So I'm glad I didn't know, you know, all of the logistical nightmares that would potentially happen, because everything was new. So I just rolled with it and I learned along the way.
I have a question about this, because I would think for myself, and I'm terrible at business stuff, that there'd be a large part of me that would think, all I want to do is conduct. I don't want to have to do all this business stuff. Did you have some difficulty with that it took so much of your time? And did you realize early on that, okay, this is what my life is going to be like for a while?
Yeah, I did, because I knew that I was doing things differently. I didn't do the traditional path. And in classical music, there tend to be some traditional paths people take. And especially in conducting, the trajectory is you do a bachelor's degree as an instrumentalist, vocalist, whatever it might be. You do a master's degree, hopefully from a big conservatory or a top university in conducting. And then you try and find your way into maybe an assistant conductor position with a tiny regional orchestra. And it's baby steps. It's very gradual. And for me, I didn't have a conducting degree, and I was getting my start by just starting my own group. And so I knew, until I found other opportunities, until people trusted me and viewed me as a conductor and not as this trumpet player who started this little thing on the side, you know, this little pet project. Until that was not viewed as a pet project, but something serious, I knew that I was only going to get experience if I created it for myself. So it was frustrating how much time was going into these events, but there was also a really great satisfaction I had from like seeing the finished product and knowing like I was a part of all of this, whether it was me entirely or, you know, me, you know, having a say in a lot of things and having some other help. It's like everything down to the color of the napkin that was served with the drink was something I had been in a discussion about. And it's so powerful when the concert, the finished product you saw from absolute start to finish, it's the side of things professional musicians tend not to know exist. They don't have as much exposure to what happens behind the scenes. And so I was grateful for it, but it was humbling to know that like, I'm only going to get to stand in front of musicians again once I'm able to figure out how to fund this and have a venue and have music stands and things like that.
But I would think an experience like that, especially when you're starting out as a conductor, will pay huge dividends later on because you'll know about the music business, a lot more about the business of music than most conductors will, in terms of putting together a concert and what you really need to think of.
Yeah, well, it's funny. And now at this later stage, nearly 10 years after I had started Elevate, where I am a little more entrenched in the traditional side of the industry and I'm, you know, applying myself for various music director positions with orchestras around the country, that is the thing that stands out and comes up in interviews the most, is they always want to know, like, tell us more about your experiences with fundraising and, you know, talking to donors and networking and all of these other aspects. And so those are the experiences that are, I think, most advantageous to me, even over the artistic experiences.
And now, I mean, you really have a lot of career things going on. And part of that, I think, is through a couple of mentors that you've had. Probably the most famous is Michael Tilson Thomas. And how did you meet him? Was that through the Elevate Ensemble?
It was not. So to very quickly gloss from starting Elevate to meeting Michael Tilson Thomas, and I was running Elevate for a couple of years. I then got an assistant conductor position with a community orchestra, an amateur orchestra in the Bay Area. And that gave me experience with a full symphony, which was great.
So you got the assistant conductor of a small community symphony because of Elevate Ensemble?
Absolutely. Because I had a track record of being a conductor, having my own group, and those things we were discussing, like I understood how an orchestra or, you know, a music ensemble functioned and what was going on behind the scenes. So I applied for this job, was invited to audition, and it was a paid job. It was a very fascinating group called the Peninsula Symphony because they're a community orchestra, but they have a real budget. They had, I think it was like $500,000 annual budget. And so they could have a small paid staff and they would bring in like big name soloists to be the soloist with this group. And so I got this staff, you know, assistant conductor position there, and I got to conduct the overture on every program. So I was getting consistent podium time, and then I got to do the one kids concert and the one, you know, run out concert a year were entirely mine. But I got that, and then I ended up winning a music director post of a community chamber orchestra. So then I became officially a music director of a community orchestra. And then I started working as an assistant conductor to the San Francisco Symphony, just through networks and things like that and getting to know artistic administrators from the symphony. They reached out to me randomly one day, and I had been for years sitting in on symphony rehearsals. That was a thing. I made sure I found my way into San Francisco symphony rehearsals, because a community orchestra is one thing, you know, ensemble, little ensemble you're running is another. But I needed to see how does a conductor approach day one of Beethoven 5 with an orchestra that's played this piece 1,000 times? Like, what does that even look like? I had never seen this. And so at the time I had another mentor I found named Alistair Neal, who's an extraordinary conductor as well. He still is music director of the Marin Symphony out there. He had been associate conductor of San Francisco Symphony for about a decade, and also still is director of the Sun Valley Symphony, which is a summer festival orchestra. It's extraordinary in Idaho. And so I started working with him, and he introduced me. I told him I need to see the rehearsal process, and he connected me with MTT's assistant, the assistant to the music director in San Francisco. And she said, sure, send me your CV. So it wasn't just a, oh, great, yeah, you can come watch. It was like, I was being vetted just to even be able to sit in and observe rehearsals. And that went fine. So then I started going as much as I could. And flash forward, almost like maybe a year and a half later, someone from San Francisco Symphony reached out and said, we have money in the budget. We need some cover. We need a cover conductor for a few weeks. Here's our schedule in the next couple months. We can bring you in for 4 weeks. Pick the weeks you can do. And so I started working with San Francisco Symphony.
And a cover conductor is?
Cover conductor is the backup. It's basically the understudy. And so I'm there in the event of everything going wrong and a conductor having to leave. Maybe it's a family emergency. Maybe, God forbid, they trip and fall and break their arm. Whatever it could be that they have to leave and they can't be there. There is someone in the building who knows this music and can lead the orchestra through it. And so that's the worst case scenario part of the job. The majority of what it is you're the only one sitting out in the hall and you're taking balance notes. And oftentimes in the rehearsal, the conductor or a soloist will look out and go, hey, can you hear me playing? Is the orchestra too loud? Can you hear the harp? Can you hear the trumpet, whatever it might be? And you basically are the ears for that conductor out in the hall so that hopefully the finished product that's getting to the audience is as balanced as possible. So that's kind of the day-to-day of being a cover.
And you were the cover conductor for some great conductors. And I wonder if you could just talk about what you learned from them. So the specific people I'm thinking of is Michael Tilson Thomas, of course, Manfred Hoenig, who's the music director of Pittsburgh Symphony, Esa-Pekka Salonen, who's been all over the world, but is now the music director of the San Francisco Symphony, and Daniel Harding. So let's start with Michael Tilson Thomas. We could spend a lot of time with him because, of course, you're at the New World Symphony. Actually, let's wait on Michael Tilson Thomas. We can talk about him later on with the New World Symphony. So Manfred Hoenig, I remember you telling me that he was a very, very nice man when you were working with him.
He's one of the most important people I've seen. And it's funny because when we toss around the term mentor, I think for a lot of people, or most people, you would think that means someone you spend a lot of time with is a mentor. Maybe someone you've known for years, you worked with, you know, a teacher that you worked with every week for, you know, through college or something like that. But it's very different, I think, in conducting, because conducting is such a fleeting, you know, people are all over the map. Guest conducting, they hop in for a week, they leave. Even a music director is not, they're not there every week. You know, they're there a few weeks a season. And so when I assisted Manfred Hoenig, I assisted him twice with the San Francisco Symphony. The first program, it was Prokofiev, Sinfonia Concertante, the massive cello concerto. Truls Mork was the soloist, and 50-minute cello concerto. So that was the first half, and then it was Dvorak 8. And so I assisted him on this, and while the Prokofiev's not done too often, Dvorak 8's about as standard as it gets. And so this was exactly what I needed to be seeing, was how do you take a piece that youth orchestras do? I think it's one of the more common youth orchestra programmed symphonies, and do that with the San Francisco Symphony. And Manfred had such a deep interpretation and a way of looking at everything. It was as if you've never heard the symphony. And the thing I learned from him the most was I would sit with him in his dressing room at the breaks or the intervals of each of the rehearsals and after rehearsals and even after concerts. He would actually want to know. He'd say, Chad, tell me what you heard. You know, what are things that you heard, things that, you know, aren't balanced, things that maybe you disagree with. And, you know, he's very open and very open to hearing what me, this young peon, I don't even know, you know, but he was genuinely like, Chad, tell me your thoughts on this. And I remember looking over at him the first time I went into his dressing room, and he had his score for Dvorak 8. It was so old and so worn that the binding had disintegrated. He was literally doing rehearsals off of a score where he was picking up the individual pages. Now, he was mostly doing it from memory, and of course the concerts were all from memory, but he just seeing that and going, oh my God, like, how many hours has this man spent? How many years has this man spent with this piece? And it was very evident in his rehearsals and how he spoke with the orchestra, his suggestions, whether it was emotional suggestions, what's the character of this spot, or technical suggestions. It was just, he had an idea of how he believed the symphony should go, and everyone went with it. There was no doubting it. And so he was just incredible. I got to work with him again later. He stepped in for a conductor who had to pull out last minute, and Manfred replaced him and did a whole program of Viennese waltzes, which for me, I had never been exposed to them. And to have someone who played in Vienna, Phil, who, you know, is a master of that genre, I got to just watch for a week, and I took so many notes. you know, on just Viennese waltzes. And so for me, like whenever I have a chance to program them, I throw them on because it's something that I now have a much deeper understanding of. So he was extraordinary. And I will say very quickly, he also, when he returned for that second week, it was the next season for this Strauss program, I was assisting him. And it was the week before my New World Symphony audition. And coincidence, I ended up being asked to do Dvorak 8 for my audition. So I talked to Manfred after our, maybe it was the last Friday morning rehearsal. And I said, Manfred, I don't know if you have any time. I have an audition next week for New World Symphony. I'm conducting Dvorak 8, the first two movements. You know, could I ask you some things? And he said, of course, sit down. 2 hours. He stayed with me for 2 hours in his dressing room and we talked up through the piece. Can I borrow a pencil, Chad? And he would mark in my score like suggestions. These are the bowings that I think work really well. I found this works, you know, and what an incredible thing to do. He doesn't have to do that. And I've worked with plenty of conductors. Everyone's been nice. I've never worked with anyone who's a jerk, thank God. But there are people, they don't have to do that. There are people who are busy and they don't want to talk to me. They don't want to hear the balance notes. They go, oh, it'll resolve itself later, or I can hear everything. Like, and I don't really even talk to them that much, and that's fine. But for this man to like dedicate time to just spend with me. So I credit him with part of, you know, a reason for why I ended up getting the job I currently have.
What about SFX Salonen? You were cover for him just for one concert?
Two programs as well. And the first time was a very interesting one because he wasn't supposed to be conducting. So it was another instance. It was supposed to be someone else who backed out last minute. And they replaced with Esa-Pekka, who 2 weeks earlier was announced as the San Francisco Symphony's next music director. So he got to come in 2 weeks later after that announcement went public and the world was just like, oh my God, this is, you know, big news. And it was a program. It was massive. It started with a piece by the Icelandic composer Anna Thorvaldsdottir called Metacosmos. And then it was Zarathustra and then Break. So it was like, okay, the first half is also Sprague Zarathustra, like, okay. And then the second half was Sibelius, the Four Legends of the Kalevala, which I knew the Swan of Tuonela. Most people know that. That movement gets done, you know, big English horn feature. But at least in the States, all four of these movements really don't get done very often. So it was very cool to just have Esa-Pekka come in and get to see him do, you know, some Sibelius, which he was especially known for. Assisting him was very different. He has such an interesting presence and energy because you have that Finnish coolness. I'm not going to say cold, but there's a coolness and a calmness to him. But then you have all those years that he was director of LA Phil, and there's this LA hip kind of vibe to him. And so he was a very interesting person. He's very sarcastic. He's very self-deprecating. For a conductor, he's incredibly self-deprecating, which I think is very endearing and helps him with the way he connects with an orchestra. But he is a lot more direct, cut and dry. He's not overly romantic in how he talks to an orchestra. He's not waxing poetically. He's not giving big similes or metaphors or whatever it might be. It's very, all right, this needs to be dry or secco, very short here, crisp, punchy. All right, let's do it. And that's it. And so it was a very different approach, but seeing him with the same orchestra, he got entirely different results than Manfred or Daniel Harding, who was the first person I assisted. So my first time assisting San Francisco Symphony was Daniel Harding. And the big piece on the program was Alpine Symphony. So I got to be involved in some really incredible programs. And that was a fascinating one because my first day there, they did a run through in the first half of the rehearsal of Alpine. And then they took their break and they came back and they started 20 minutes in or so, or maybe 10 minutes into the piece. And then the head of the artistic planning department of the San Francisco Symphony walked out into the hall. And I'm the only person sitting in the hall right now, just taking little balance notes and whatever. And just in awe that I'm getting paid to sit here and like have the San Francisco Symphony play for me. You know, that's what it feels like when you're the only audience member. And this higher up from admin comes out and he says, hey, Chad, how's it going? I'm like, oh, it's great. He's like, having a good time? I'm like, yeah, I'm so grateful to be here. He's like, how'd you feel about conducting like the offstage brass for Alpine Symphony? I was like, sure, like tomorrow. He's like, no, right now, actually. It fell apart and they said they're going to refuse to do it unless they have a conductor backstage with them. And at this point, the orchestra's running this. Daniel Harding on the podium doesn't know that the players were unhappy with that, that they're refusing to play unless there's a conductor. And they're approaching that passage. So I of course say, yes. And so I grab my score, I grab my baton, and he leads me backstage. They take me around the back ring of the hall. All the administrative staff were backstage just sort of watching, because it's like, I guess this is going to be a crash or burn moment. And so I walk back to the other side. It was, I think, 14 players they had for offstage. And they open, you know, stage manager opens the door so that the sound's going to come. And I cue them in. And Daniel Harding cuts off in the middle of it because it's not together. And this isn't my fault. Well, the reason why it wasn't working in the run through is because he was taking time in the sections that have the offstage, which I've never seen done. Usually people just keep it straight. It makes it easier. And offstage, they have a little TV in the back, a little monitor. But when the conductor's taking time and you have 14 brass players crammed backstage playing as loud as they can, they can't hear, they can't see this little screen. And so they wheeled out a monitor for me so that I could watch and follow what Daniel's doing on the monitor while cueing everyone in. And it ended up going really well, but it was very surreal because it was like my first day there. I got to like stand in front of some of the musicians, and it was, you know, people I knew, like faces I knew, names I knew. It was like Mark Lawrence, who was former principal trombone there in San Francisco.
Sure.
He was playing offstage. They flew in Gail Williams, was playing horn offstage. It was like,
wow,
it was
great.
Yeah, it was like, I looked at every face and was like, I know these people. I've seen them in books. I've known people that have studied with them. And I'm like, and now I get to stand in front of them. And so I ended up, they had me do that for all the rehearsals and all the shows, and it went well. And yeah, Daniel was very interesting too, because he has a very different approach. I think his European upbringing, he's also someone who's very direct, very curt. It's that, you know, English, grew up in Paris. You get, I think a lot of American conductors, and myself included, are very warm. And there's a lot of smiles and brightness. And for him, it was very direct and very sarcastic and very just kind of like a little bit more hands off and letting the music sort of just happen a lot and then finding places to come in. And but it was just, yeah, I just that was my first time, you know, with a professional orchestra, and I got to be involved performing it. So it was incredible.
Were you nervous?
Yes.
I would be scared to death, I think.
I remember for the first concert, they asked me to cue the stage hand who's going to open the door, you know, a couple bars before. And I was so buried in the score, making sure I'm going to not screw this up and that I know where I am, that I was like, oh my God, I think I was supposed to cue the door person a bar ago. So then I had to turn and be like, and it was like one bar and then we're in. So it was fine, but it was like, it was overwhelming, you know, and it's a small thing. It's 45 seconds of music that happens off stage, and that's it. You don't get acknowledged for anything. That's it. You're done. And then you leave. But it was very intense experience for me, but I'm so glad it happened.
Join Tony and Chad in part two, where they talk about Chad's time with the San Francisco Ballet and how conducting a ballet is so different from conducting an orchestra. From there, they move on to the New World Symphony and the importance of score study and some strategies that Chad has for score analysis. Thank you for joining us, and if you're enjoying these interviews, please be sure to subscribe to the podcast and help us spread the word.